Welcome to Lexis, the podcast all about language and linguistics. I'm Lisa Casey.
I'm Jackie Glancy.
I'm Dan Clayton.
And I'm Jill Lavender.
So, welcome to this episode of Lexis, and on this edition, we're really pleased to talk to Dan Collin, who is an online hate researcher for an educational project based in Toronto as part of the Toronto Holocaust Museum. And we were interested in talking to Dan because he was one of the authors on a report called Weaponized Laughter, Memes and Hate in the Canadian Digital Landscape. And that's part of the work that he's been doing with Hatepedia, which is an online database resource center built with research to provide educators, parents, lawmakers, and researchers with tools to identify and counter the proliferation of online hate. So thanks for joining us, Dan.
Thank you for having me.
And we will give a content warning for this episode, clearly, because the content that we're going to be looking at will be to do with discrimination and hate speech. So if those are issues that you don't want to deal with in your classroom at the moment, then please listen no further. We'll be talking about some of the ways in which online hate speech can be countered as well. So there'll be positives in among.
I was going to say, on that cheery note, what a lovely welcome.
Yeah. So, hey.
So Dan, can you tell us about the Weaponized Laughter Memes report, about why you compiled it and the processes by which you put it together?
Yes. Thank you for the introduction, by the way. I feel just a slight pressure to end on an upbeat note now, so I'll keep that in the back of my mind. Yeah, so Weaponized Laughter is the report of findings between myself and my research partner, Etienne Quintel, at the Online Hate Research and Education Project at the Toronto Holocaust Museum, and our website, hatepedia.ca, which we created to publish the resources we created during our time. And Weaponized Laughter details our findings into the primary study that the Online Hate Research and Education Project undertook, and that is a large-scale study of memes demonstrating hate speech that were shared by Canadian social media accounts. We looked at a total of 8 platforms, but mostly focused on between like 5 or 6 as being ones that we looked at, over 100 accounts and a total of just under, in the end, 3,000 memes. And after peer review and taking out memes that were duplicates or memes that did not necessarily, we weren't 100% confident in, we ended up with around 2,800 examples of memes demonstrating hate speech in Canada. And Weaponized Laughter details some of the findings comparing memes to each other, particularly how particular groups were targeted by specific memes, how particular narratives and stories were portrayed in memes, and particularly how memes representing different hate movements or even specific hate groups targeted people differently.
So you're, if I'm remembering correctly, part of the grant funding came from the Toronto Holocaust Museum. So I'm assuming it was it coming at the research from an angle of looking specifically at sort of anti-Jewish hate? Because I know that comes out quite strongly in the report. But was that a preliminary concern, or was that something that just happened to come out when you looked at hate speech in general?
So that's a great question. We got, and it's a very understandable one, we got that a lot as a project initiated by Holocaust Museum. And formally, when we started the project, it was called the Sarah and Haim Neuberger US Education Center. So it was a Holocaust Education Center project. We often were under the assumption that we were looking primarily at anti-Semitism, but actually that wasn't the case. We were funded by the Government of Canada's Anti-Racism Action Program. And our study was looked at hate speech for every identifiable group. Part of the reason why anti-Semitism might be represented heavily in the report is just personal biases. The kind of accounts we looked at, the ones we knew, it may have just been easier to find anti-Semitism. It's not necessarily to say that there is that exactly that much proportional anti-Semitism compared to other forms of hate on the internet or in the internet in Canada. Of course, we only looked at, you know, under 3,000 internet memes over a period of a couple of years. The internet in Canada is very vast, and comparing how much hate there is from one group to another would be very difficult. Additionally, we also looked at only English and French language, so that's another limitation. We talked specifically about some groups that we found to be underrepresented, and we thought we would find more hate speech towards in internet memes. And this kind of leads to another reason that it might have been that anti-Semitism was represented, and that is that anti-Semitic groups, hate movements, particularly far right-wing extremist movements, have been using the internet very effectively for a very long time and have used the internet alongside the proliferation of internet memes. So internet memes are a phenomenon that right-wing extremist groups are particularly savvy with. We didn't just look at right-wing extremist groups, but being that we looked at hate movements that posted internet memes, and being that right-wing extremist groups are so prolific and widespread right now in Canada and other places, it was much easier to find accounts for that sort of content. We have these tropes that existed for a long time before the age of the internet to push anti-Semitism, and anti-Semitism is a very effective form of hate speech that movements often use first before they intersect it with other hate movements. And we also know that like websites like 4chan and Something Awful and Reddit years ago to some extent have had this culture of right-wing extremism proliferating there, where people often targeted Jews specifically through those kinds of campaigns. So internet memes history is one that's seeped in, anti-Semitic memes kind of just being, unfortunately, not necessarily a part we want to talk about, but a very large part of the development of internet memes for a long time. So that might have been some of the reasons that anti-Semitism was so proportionally highly represented in our study.
And just sort of going back to the sort of basics in terms of sort of terminology, how would you actually kind of define a meme, and how would you define what you might class as hate speech?
That's a great question. Memes can be a lot of different things, and it's in a very literal sense a much more general term. The internet kind of changed people's understanding of what the word meme means. So memes don't have to be the way we use them. It may be very surface level for listeners of a linguistics podcast, but Richard Dawkins coined the term meme as a unit of cultural transmission. And that's been applied to common expressions and visual gestures to say that they're memes because they convey anything that we understand culturally to be a specific message shared towards someone else. So when people hear terms like never forget, that's technically a meme. Catchphrases can be memes. Anything that conveys knowledge that is very culturally specific. But in this study, we looked at internet memes, and internet memes is possibly more debated, but also it's typically understood to be something that isn't necessarily a literal definition of meme. And so for this study, we looked at static images and moving images specifically that conveyed specific messaging in that kind of terminology. So we looked at images specifically and videos specifically that were visual messages for this, and things that were posted specifically on social media, with the exception of Discord, which we wanted to look at. Everything we looked at was publicly available, so posted to a public social media account, and was either an image macro or a short video.
And then in terms of how you classify what you would kind of count as hate speech, what sort of definition would you apply to that?
It's a very good question, and it's one we had to actually put a lot of thought into interpreting. In Canada, so hate speech is most often prohibited by federal laws under different sections of Canada's criminal code. But the code itself does not actually define, it doesn't include a definition of hate speech. It doesn't define it. Some Canadian provinces do define hate speech. Our province, Ontario, which Toronto is in, and this project was conducted from, although our data was Canada-wide, not Ontario-wide. But Ontario is the province we worked in, and Ontario has a very clear human rights code, but it does not include a definition of hate speech. It's very specific about who is protected by hate speech. So we use that framework. And as a way of bridging the gap between who is targeted and how to define what was targeted them, we used a framework proposed by a celebrated human rights lawyer, Richard Warman, called the Hallmarks of Hate. The Hallmarks of Hate have been used in Canadian case law before, and they're essentially 11 ways that a message can portray or speak towards or speak of a targeted group that could be conveyed as hate speech. So the Hallmarks of Hate define things said about targeted groups as being hateful if the following. So there's 11. The first one is the targeted group is portrayed as a powerful menace that is taking control of the major institutions of society and depriving others of their livelihoods, safety, freedom of speech, and general well-being. Hallmark 2 is the messages use true stories, news reports, pictures, and references from purportedly reputable news sources to make negative generalizations about the targeted group. Hallmark 3, the targeted group is portrayed as preying upon children, the elderly, or the vulnerable. Fourth, the targeted group is blamed for current problems in societies and the world. Fifth, the targeted group is portrayed as dangerous or violent by nature. Sixth, the message conveys the idea that members of the target group are devoid of any redeeming qualities and are innately evil. Seven, the message communicates the idea that nothing but the banishment, segregation, or eradication of this group of people will save others from the harm being done. Eight, the targeted group is dehumanized through comparisons to and associations with animals, vermin, excrement, and other noxious substances. Nine, the use of highly inflammatory and derogatory language is used to create a tone of extreme hatred or contempt towards the target group. 10, the message trivializes or celebrates past persecutions or tragedies involving members of the targeted group. And the 11th hallmark is direct calls to take a violent action towards the targeted group.
Right.
So the language I used there, I will say, was I'm paraphrasing Mark Goldberg, who summarized the hallmarks in 2006, but very true to the way that they've been applied. Sometimes they're paraphrased differently in different contexts, but the underlying message rarely ever changes.
And yeah, this is you're running through the hallmarks of hate there, and they're so recognizable as kind of as long-standing tropes and strategies that actually we've discussed a number of times on the podcast, often used in political discourse to make enemies of particular groups that a political party is choosing to criminalize or to kind of target. I don't know if you're aware, there's a fairly long-standing discussion that's at work in the UK at the moment over the Home Secretary's rhetoric around migrants coming to the UK on small boats. And there are elements of the rhetoric that you've just described that are clearly in evidence in some of the speeches that are coming out of the House of Commons at the moment. So it's really, really interesting to have them laid out one after the other like that in a row.
I mean, the other thing that struck me as well is that idea of the kind of threat to children and all of the discourses around trans people and labels of groomers and things like this, which is being applied. And there's, you know, the culture wars that are being fought around that. Every debate about particular minoritized groups seems to kind of draw on, you know, one or more of those categories, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. We found it. So it was my partner Etienne's idea to use the hallmarks in our methodology when looking at internet memes. And so in our study, we noted down which hallmarks, if any, were represented in hate speech. And typically with very little, considering it's so succinct that, you know, I could say it all on a podcast, considering it's so compact, it was quite amazing how easy it is to apply most of them to what we understood to be hate speech in looking at it. There was a few interpretations that we noted specifically in our report that were not explicitly laid out in the hallmarks themselves. So for example, hallmark number 8 mentions dehumanization through comparisons or associations with animals, vermin, excrement. We also included racist caricatures, just for example, depictions of like minstrel blackface in the American context, or meme characters such as people who are online and savvy to hateful imagery on the internet might be familiar with the Happy Merchant. So we considered use of the Happy Merchant to be some adaptation of Hallmark 8, as the targeted group was dehumanized into a listed thing, but through comparison to a racist depiction of the group itself. We adapted, we included notes on how we interpreted the hallmarks and how we looked at our data. But for the most part, we found it to be a very easy 11 key trope, or not tropes, but strategies that hate speech used, and found it to be very easy to apply to what we understood.
Yeah. So could you give us some examples perhaps of some sort of innocent classic memes and how they work, and then compare them to the sort of memes that you saw in your project?
Yeah. And to that point, just before I do it, I'd say maybe one thing that's very interesting that is something that I think might surprise people. We talk about how a lot of the memes are looked to be intended to be coded in humor, and many of them aren't. There are just very serious messaging. There are image macros that don't have much of a punchline and that are very hateful. And I think there's often this interpretation where the ones that are presented as less serious or more comical are often kind of surface level. And a lot of the time they are. So comical memes are used to funnel people into hate movements by normalizing the hateful messaging through humor. But that also stays with more extreme hate speech too. And as movements get more extreme, basically the further someone goes down a pipeline, it doesn't necessarily mean that that humor or comical sense is lost. It doesn't necessarily mean the memes are going to be more serious. So we found a lot of very, very offensive memes that we not have been able to include even in the reports already. Quite a heavy read as it is, but that did try to pass themselves off as humor, albeit just very shocking and offensive humor. So, sorry, back to your question. Yeah, as internet memes, as they're understood, don't necessarily mean to be hateful. So back in when I was of the age that was adapting to the internet, and some older listeners, and I don't want to, at the risk of dating any of the listeners, this podcast might be familiar with like advice animals as internet memes. So just image macros with very static backgrounds and images of like animals' faces in the middle and impact fonts, bold, all capitals, top and bottom. And there would be a particular flavor to the message being prescribed. Yeah. Eventually that advice animals format went to things that weren't animals, like the Ermagerd girl. Ones that have lived on longer than that, advice animals are most often formats. So a common format that has lived on a long time and lends itself to a lot of messaging because you don't need to understand any of the context before and after seeing it. You don't need to have seen it before to understand it is the overly attached boyfriend meme. Mm-hmm. Another that's not quite there, but maybe more recent, and it remains to be seen how much lasting power it has, is the salad cat, where a white cat looks angrily towards something to show disgust. And I'm shamelessly mentioning that as it's also from my hometown of Ottawa, Ontario.
Right.
And a variety of common meme formats, if people are browsing online, might include SpongeBob SquarePants memes. There's a lot that can be made out of that. Since the characters are so expressive in that television show, there's a lot of scenes from the show that lend themselves well to making the message very obvious, and it translates very well between different languages. And they're well recognized as being family friendly and fun, as the show's been around so long. So there's nothing offensive about memes that adapt themselves from cartoons like SpongeBob.
Well, I guess that adaptability is part of the essence of memes, isn't it? Is that sense in which it's like a sort of template that's kind of varied, it's slightly kind of changed each time it's adapted and moves on. You've got that kind of evolutionary element, haven't you, to them? But you've also got, I suppose, they're quite niche in many ways as well, aren't they? I mean, if I'm thinking of like my dad, who's in his early 80s, if I showed him some of these and said, these are funny memes from the internet, he'd look at them and he would have no idea what any of them meant, why they were funny. He wouldn't find them funny. He'd think they're ridiculous. So there is this kind of sense, isn't there, with them, that there's the audience for them is a very online audience a lot of the time, isn't it? And maybe, but that means of a certain age group or certain age groups or different generations. What's kind of striking about using memes then maybe for promoting hate speech is it kind of talking to a small audience who really get these, or do you think they're addressing a wider audience?
It really depends on the internet meme, and it's an excellent question for that reason. So we talked about, and I mentioned, like something like the overly attached boyfriend meme is it doesn't have any characters or lore, for lack of a better word, that Well, actually, I'm on a linguistics podcast, so I shouldn't say for lack of a better word. There's always going to be a better word. I may just not know it. But there's background information that's not going to be known to people to make something easy for everyone to recognize. And one way that hate memes can, I guess, lazily promote a message is to use that same kind of format and put a hate message out there. But there's also meme characters and meme formats that are also very specific to particular subcultures because they develop their own culture alongside the medium. So I mean, you mentioned like the idea that it might be sort of, I think age might have been the word you used, but a generational thing. So I think it's both a generational thing and an instance where a medium itself impacts the message. Mm-hmm. Like internet memes developed alongside the internet, as we talked about earlier. So some of the message is dependent on understanding that environment always. And this includes a lot of offensive materials, as the internet was the best place, like we talked about earlier, for particular kinds of extremist groups to organize. The internet allowed a safety and anonymity and less risk to speaking with like-minded people to build a movement. So right-wing extremists have always been there, as mentioned earlier, but likewise, other messages have been impacted by the medium. So for example, newspapers there's a certain weight we've accepted as people to sections of the newspaper. As readers, we expect that A1 is going to have the biggest stories. We expect that if you want to find stories about sports, you go to the sports section particularly. In the same way that someone unfamiliar with social media is going to not understand the importance of something being the top post of r/funny for 3 days, someone unfamiliar with the newspaper is not going to understand the importance of a story being A1 in the New York Times. And what we don't expect is that the comment section, the most image-based part of the newspaper, serves any purpose other than to make us laugh. Political cartoons and papers shift this, of course, but we have like an idea of when we see a Garfield comic in the paper that we anticipate the message is going to be deadpan and inoffensive because we recognize Garfield. Likewise, when we see an internet meme character like Pepe the Frog, we anticipate the message might be intentionally offensive, as that is a character far more often presented in that kind of messaging. But if you're unfamiliar with the internet and the medium to which Pepe the Frog pops up in, unlike Garfield, which we more understood has been around for a lot longer, you're not going to be familiar with that background and you're not going to know what necessarily to expect. And you're not might not necessarily understand all of what that character is saying or doing because you don't understand the lore that's been built up around them. The background for characters, meme characters and meme formats is built up by a community and it's very much an anonymous popularity contest, a big show. So you don't have that same kind of control that we look at from image-based messaging like newspaper comments.
Yeah. And some the report does print some of the memes that appeared. And again, trigger warning on some of those because some of them are awful. But there are a bunch that I didn't understand at all. Like I didn't get what it was. And I kind of I had a sort of an unpleasant feeling that something unpleasant was being said, but I didn't know exactly what it was with some of them. But with others, it was obvious and it was grotesque. So for example, we had in one that I remember a bunch of kind of overtly left-wing flags. So a Black Lives Matter movement flag, an anti-fascist flag, and kind of a pride and trans visibility flag. Kind of flying and then kind of stood behind them, this kind of horrific caricature of a Jewish figure, with the implicature being that somehow Jewish society is sitting behind anti-fascist movements, I guess was the implication of sort of the meme. Again, one that was clearly, I could clearly figure out what the message was, even with sort of minimal context. I say minimal, I recognize the flags. So I guess that was some context there. But the characterization of the Jewish figure was cartoonish in how absurd it was. It was sort of wearing a big Star of David around its neck and had kind of, you know, the grotesque cartoonish sort of supposedly Jewish profile, etc.
I think it's helpful to recognize, like, we recognize what those flags and those symbols mean, and we recognize what an anti-Semitic character often looks like. We can piece together, you can piece together what that meme represents when you look at it. But if a crude anti-Semitic caricature was unfamiliar to someone, that might be a different story. Likewise, BLM we often know as a placeholder for just to represent Black people, sometimes to represent Black civil rights movements. It doesn't always represent BLM, which is also the name of an organization. So we understand that a lot of attacks on BLM are going to be necessarily racist and not attacking BLM, the organization. It's going to be attacking Black civil rights movements. Mm-hmm. We also know that when there's a shady Jewish person, it's often a trope behind something to say that Black people are controlled by a sinister force is also a trope that's commonly used. So even though we don't necessarily think about what we need to understand to feed these messages, there is a lot of cultural understanding we do need to understand to be able to interpret even a meme that is maybe less layered like that one. Mm-hmm. And so some of the ones that are more complicated, there's still different layers of cultural understanding. It's just maybe more layers or maybe different layers depending on the meme, because it's ones that originated necessarily on the internet and haven't made it to what we could call the physical realm. As in people that don't necessarily spend so much time online, they recognize what a BLM flag and an anti-fascist flag might represent.
Yeah.
I was interested by the clustering of things together. So the idea that anything that is broadly sort of left wing was painted as awful or sinister or up to something dubious and we don't really know what it is. We just know we don't like it, sort of was the implicature that came through from lots of them.
And probably funded by George Soros.
Obviously, this leads to some sort of deeper questions about the effects and the impact impacts of all of this? So having been neck deep in it for as long as you have, do we need to be concerned about this? Is this just the way it is? Is it just language, at work, and it's not something that we need to concern ourselves with? Or do you think there's more to it?
I think we should be concerned. I think there's more to it. We should be concerned because the people who are actively recruiting into hate movements are putting a lot of thought into their language. And this means language as we understand it, the spoken and written word, where they're actively taking language and warping the meaning to further their causes and make their causes plausible to mainstream audiences. So we see this with the far right recently mainstreaming the use of the word woke as a dog whistle. Woke was co-opted language from Black culture, and they've been effectively using the word to represent anything that they believe is affirming diversity and equality, or sometimes just represent LGBTQ plus rights. And they often use it in a way that is still fluid enough to plausibly deny that people are using it in a homophobic or transphobic or racist way, or as a dog whistle. And they're using it in a way that's fluid enough that people who are using it in those sense might not know that they're using it that way. Mm-hmm. Likewise, the use of George Soros as an anti-Semitic dog whistle before and in the last few years prior to woke has also been normalized so much so that it's very difficult to tell when George Soros is used as a placeholder for some kind of sinister control if the messenger is intentionally being anti-Semitic, because people who were intentionally anti-Semitic when they were using it as a dog whistle have normalized the use of that word so much. So for that reason, it's important to look at that kind of language. But this also includes the language of symbols and that we're talking about today. Some hate symbols are created by hate movements. Some are co-opted and some are made to be intentionally absurd or to convince people who may be out of touch with contemporary language and humor, like parents and teachers of children that are being recruited, that the message isn't hateful. So even a commonly used term for this kind of strategy in far right-wing extremist networks is made to be intentionally absurd. And that's kind of how on the nose it can be. That strategy is called, quote, hiding your power level. And it's meant to sound like it might be a reference to an anime or a video game, something that a parent or a teacher would ignore. They saw their child or their student talk about. But in practice, it can be a term for concealing extremely hateful beliefs that lead to ideologically motivated violence. And so the fact that this much effort is being put into hate movements, into making their language difficult to discern, means it's just going to be more concerning for us. And we've seen
that's the weaponizing the laughter bit, right? It's the passing it off as something lighthearted and superficial, whereas in truth, it's deeply insidious and really, really divisive.
Yeah, credit to Etienne for the name. Shout out. I think it's perfect. And it is quite literally weaponized laughter that we're talking about.
And that idea of plausible deniability that you mentioned is a really interesting one, because I remember we were talking, I think you might have talked a long time ago about kind of things like the symbolic significance of things like taking the knee. How that was, Colin Kaepernick was doing that, and then that became a kind of symbolic kind of thing that was done in UK football to show solidarity with anti-racist causes. And then there were other kind of like physical gestures. So you had, like, with the far right, the idea of like the kind of okay sign, which could be read as like what meaning white power, which, if you see them and say that's a far right symbol, they can say, oh no, it's just a joke. And it's like kind of that sort of something seems inbuilt, doesn't it, with like memes and that kind of sense of like playfulness, humor, but deniability that makes this quite difficult to pin down. You sound like you're a kind of miserable old boomer if you're kind of saying things like, oh, what you've, Pepe the Frog is a fascist meme. And then saying, no, it's not. It's just sort of a playful thing on the internet.
That's exactly why that the okay hand gesture was chosen to be co-opted too. The people on 4chan that were trying to normalize that as a hate symbol wanted people to be, they wanted to be able to mock people who took it seriously while at the same time using it seriously. It's a very effective strategy.
But I mean, we see it every day. We see it every day in schools with obviously we work with teenagers, Dan and I. Our age group was sort of 11 to 18. With kids who are kind of sucked into frequently YouTube, but lots of internet kind of social media related stuff that they get into because they think it's funny. Like Andrew Tate initially, a bunch of our boys were watching him because they thought he was hilarious. Except, of course, the more you watch him, the more sort of normalized his narratives about women become. And suddenly you've watched, hours and hours and hours of a guy ranting about the way that you're meant to treat women, that where suddenly it doesn't sound as mad anymore. And it's, yeah, that normalization strategy is really, really powerful. I think we talked to a couple, there's a couple of kind of researchers that we've talked to who've looked at kind of these strategies being employed very deliberately, specifically by the right, or at least being used more effectively, as you've suggested, by the right. And that's paying real dividends in terms of them recruiting people to the cause and kind of really feeling like they're aligned with the ideologies that frequently sit behind it. And I kind of reference the discussion that we're having at the minute in the UK about migrants on small boats. This is sort of the mainstreaming of elements of that narrative. So we've talked about, and there have been linguistic studies about the use of metaphors around vermin and waves and insects and crowds and swarms for migrants in the past. And I think some politicians are quite careful about not using those specific terms nowadays, but there are sort of passing references to things that you've mentioned in the hallmarks of hate that are abundantly clear in mainstream political discourse in the UK, if we care to look. And it's why we do interviews like this. It's so important that students are sort of cognizant of the things that are being put in front of them every day.
What you mentioned with Andrew Tate is a very important phenomenon. We call it, and it's not universally accepted, but we call it irony poisoning when that kind of message is repeated enough that the weight of what is being said, when you strip the humor away, becomes less heavy to the listener as it goes on until it's no longer shocking to them. And it's easier for them to plausibly take the messages serious after they've heard the joke so many times.
No, it's an interesting phrase. So the final question, there's been a lot of talk and concern recently about the role of social media in propagating hate speech and division. So what's happening online? How can students be alert to it and challenge it?
So it's well understood that disinformation can be used to normalize hate speech, and disinformation is rampant on social media. Lying can be a lot more effective at pushing hateful narratives because it takes far more effort to debunk or disprove something than it does to fabricate information. So I personally think an underexamined part of media literacy, and something that we should be teaching and emphasizing the importance of, is how disinformation in and around hate speech, and also just in general, can be profitable. I think it's easier to understand the motives of why social media companies allow, or in some cases, like alternative social media platforms like Gab, intentionally push hate speech when the monetary value for spreading that message is understood. We spend a lot of time in researchers' spheres asking what people truly believe and what they're pretending to believe for their bottom line. Does Alex Jones really believe his miracle pills work? Does David Icke talk less about Archon or lizard people because he doesn't think it's as important anymore? He thinks that the COVID and vaccines are more important, or is it because there's a bottom line here? How much will the monetary value of this suffer? How much of this is brand building for brand building? But these kinds of questions aren't ones that are obvious to the general public, who might be getting an ad for one of Alex's Jones pills, for example, or seeing likewise any kind of disinformation pushed about COVID either by a friend or by their social media algorithm. So the question of financial incentive is often very far removed from the message until we know the background. And I think that people, especially young people, were targeted by so much messaging, often more than adults in many cases. Seeing that anything can be an advertisement to anyone, social media companies, content creators, and third parties, they can make money sometimes indirectly off their clicks, is important. And I think that that includes disinformation for the sake of it, monetizing disinformation by playing to people's emotions. We talk about donorship a lot to disinformation peddlers and hate peddlers. We don't often talk about the monetary value of commenting on something online to argue with it, or angry reacting to something on Facebook, which is sometimes worth more to algorithms than simply liking it.
Is that true? So a disinformation post that has deliberately been crafted and put out might get money, some kind of monetary reward, if somebody like me commented, you're full of crap, this is racist nonsense, for example.
Well, indirectly, it can lead to. So, typically,
oh, God damn it.
if we take like a Facebook page, for example, that posts disinformation, they don't deliberately make money when you comment and angry react to something. But it can tell the Facebook algorithm to promote it to more people because it's getting interaction.
During the
Facebook whistleblower saga, some of the documents showed that angry reacts on Facebook were sometimes worth more interactions. Algorithms found that they were they would be interacted with more than shares that just necessarily had a like with them. So they sometimes promoted angry React messages more than messages with the same number of like Reacts to further audiences. And so when the algorithms promote something because they see it as legitimate, because we interact with it more, that helps get that message out and get whoever is crafting that message, for example, in this case, that Facebook page, to in front of more people's eyes. And that can lead to a return for them if there's outlinks on that page to something that they make ad revenue on.
I see. Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like I should clarify for the record that I am not an angry reactor on the internet.
There's nothing wrong with being an angry reactor. It's not the blame should not be on the individual. Just because we're talking about literacy and understanding how to navigate social media doesn't necessarily mean that there should be this onus on the consumer and user for this kind of thing.
But that's interesting information for students to have kind of going forward in their lives.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I know that hate is sometimes profitable is not the kind of optimistic message I imagine you hope
it would give. Are there things that students can do to challenge it? I mean, other than their own kind of cognizance, other than their own awareness of it.
I mean,
like, there's things they can do.
Yeah, spread that cognizance and that awareness of each other, and also flood your content with affirmative content. Fight hate with love, as tacky as it sounds. But for auditory listeners, Lisa just showed her sweater, had said love on it.
Says love is the answer.
Says love is the answer.
I thrifted it this week. I'm very proud of it. So flood your feed with love is what we need to do.
Flood your feed with love and talk to, if you're in a position where social media transparency and social media literacy is an issue that is up for discussion in politics, speak to your local politician, speak to your local lawmaker about it, and make sure that when they go into lawmaking and moderation about this sort of thing, that they're educated about what they're working with. Because social media can move very fast. Hate speech and disinformation narratives, and if you're targeting specific ones, can move very, very fast. And it's very difficult to maintain living resources and living information to maintain knowing living information about these sorts of things. So it's important to have clear conversations.
Okay, so we have a special Lang in the News segment on this episode. Normally, we would talk about some language in the news stories between us, but we have an extra guest on this one. So Hedwin Newton is an English teacher and translator with a Dutch and English background and is based between the Netherlands and England. And she runs the English in Progress newsletter, which is a really great resource, which we wanted to talk about. And in compiling that, Hedwin keeps an eye on lots of language stories in the news. So we're going to take advantage of Hedwin's knowledge about these things that are going on and pick her brains about interesting stories, how to keep up with them, and just have a look at some of the language stories that she's been grabbed by recently. So welcome to Lexis, Hedwin.
Thank you for having me.
So where does your interest in language and linguistics come from?
So you sent me these questions beforehand, so I've already been pondering them, and I had about five different potential answers for this one, but then in the end I kind of landed on that honestly, I don't really understand why other people aren't interested in languages. It is the way we communicate. It is this almost this organism that we create all together, all 7 billion of us, or however many people there are on the earth right now. And it's continually changing without any one person choosing to change it, which I think is amazing. And, you know, I live in the world and I'm 43 years old. So cognitively, I understand that which interests me does not necessarily interest other people. But why? And I almost think, like, do you think it is us? Do you think it is English teachers sort of taking this spark of joy in children from language and murdering it by telling them that how you speak is wrong, and, you know, you read this book and you felt this way about it, but actually you should have felt that way about it.
Mm.
you know, is it English teachers ruining it for everybody?
We don't have to do it like that, though, do we? I mean, I know what you mean. There are definitely ways in which I can remember in my education, and I've seen it happen in classrooms where, you know, you're told of a particular way of doing something and you kind of think, I'm not sure that's quite how I want to approach this or what I think about that. And there is that kind of tension, isn't there, within English teaching about us being sort of, I guess, language police at one, yeah, you know, one moment where we're correcting things.
It's really tricky, yeah, walking that line, I think.
Do you have any background in a kind of degree in language or linguistics or anything like that? Or
yes, I do. I have an English degree. So from a personal level, I grew up in the Netherlands, but with an English or a British mother, as you can hear from my accent probably. And I kind of grew up in an underprivileged neighborhood in Tilburg, which is in the south. And I was the only child far and wide. The immigration hadn't really started up yet for that part of the Netherlands. Mm. And I was the only child who spoke two languages. So I guess it came from that. And then it was quite natural for me to go on when I was older to actually study this language that, yeah, I spoke anyway, English. So I studied it in the Netherlands. But of course, Dutch people speak excellent English. So it's almost that studying is almost like studying it at native level.
So your interest in your own bilingualism and language as a sort of concept, I suppose, arose from that sort of early experience.
Yes, I'd say so.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, more, it's just inherent in me, and I don't understand why other people don't love it as much as I do.
I think that's an English teacher thing, isn't it? We all love our subject, and yeah, we want to see others love it too, which is healthy, but can lead to a kind of grinding obsession as well.
Well, I hope I'm not there.
It's too late for me. So can you tell us a bit about your English in Progress newsletter? So when did you set it up? What do you plan to achieve with it? What have you achieved with it so far, do you think?
Well, so first, what it is. So it is a newsletter, and it is about the English language as this living, breathing, evolving organism that keeps changing. And I have three focal points. The first is, how do young people speak English? Because, of course, talking about the future of English and how it's changing, you want to talk about young people. So their slang and their neologisms. But then I also like to talk about neologisms in general. They don't only come from young people, but they also come from the tech industry, for example, and also for some reason from human resource departments. And then sort of the third focal point is how English is spoken around the world.
Right,
so,
yeah.
So world Englishes is the official term. And then I am especially interested in how those different variants of English are now kind of merging together because of the internet and because of media. And of course, British and American English is a great example of that, where the younger people are, the more they use American terms and Americans use British terms, and nobody really knows where anything is from anymore. And also, does it matter anymore?
Yeah, yeah.
So all of that kind of stuff, I don't write about that myself. I would like to, but I don't have the time. So instead, I curate articles from all around the web, and it comes out once a month. And then I summarize those articles, and sometimes I give my own commentary.
Yeah.
So that's what the newsletter is. When did I set it up? In October last year. Why I set it up is a question that you didn't ask, but may I answer it anyway?
Go on.
Thank you. I set it up because as a Dutch person, because I am from the Netherlands, and in the Netherlands, there is this pride in the Dutch language, which of course is logical because it's a small language and not many people on earth speak it. And we have to sort of fight against English a little bit to remain of interest to young people. And because of that, in the Netherlands and in Belgium, there are quite a lot of newsletters and websites and television programs that are about Dutch as a language. And I was always looking for, where is this for English? Like, where is the newsletter about English as a language and about all the articles that come out about English and about the interesting new discoveries that have been made? And I found that it's all about linguistics in general, taking all kinds of languages together, which I understand, because of course you want to get away from the imperialism of English, which is not a nice aspect. So we do not want to write a newsletter that says English is the best language.
I can think of a few people who might do in England, but we wouldn't have them on this show.
Well, that's definitely not at all what I want to do. But I was looking for a resource that just, you know, had interesting articles about English, and I couldn't find it. So then I thought, well, let's set it up myself. And that's what I did.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's the best way to do it, isn't it? If there's something that you want that's not there, do it. It's interesting to say about the sort of the Dutch side to it and the kind of interest in, you know, the Dutch language, because I suppose maybe there's a sort of parallel with France in that you've got that sort of sense of a kind of resistance there to English and American English. And of course, you've got the Académie Française as well, haven't you? Which is there as a kind of regulator. I mean, I'm not sure it really does a great deal of kind of practical use there, because people just vote with their feet, or rather vote with their mouths, don't they? Just use what they want. But do you get a sense in the Netherlands that people feel that Dutch as a language is kind of under threat and needs to be protected, needs to be curated itself, if you like?
Yeah, well, it's funny that you should say that, because that's actually one of my favourite recent stories to talk about. Right, okay. So we don't have L'Académie Dutchaires or anything like that. We have an organisation that is really descriptivist in nature. So I'm a little bit maybe proud of my country in that sense, that they don't have this prescriptivist sense of Dutch at all. It's very much descriptivist. And of course, English has been very big in the Netherlands for years. I mean, since the Second World War. And Dutch people speak excellent English, as everybody who's ever been there will know.
Yeah.
What is currently a discussion in the Netherlands is that Dutch universities switched to English a few years ago to be more international and to be more accommodating to international students.
So as their main medium of communication?
Yes. So all Dutch professors at a Dutch university give all their lectures in English, which some people have responded badly to, which I think is understandable, because they think it is, it means that students will no longer speak good Dutch. And also, you know, why not Dutch? Dutch is a perfectly good language. You can learn geography or whatever it is in Dutch.
Yeah. Okay. So just moving on to some of the, you know, the ways in which you gather your stories. I mean, you're very... You've got a good range in there, and you talked about some of the areas that you're particularly keen on covering. Where do you find your stories about language that feature in your newsletter? What are you on the lookout for generally?
So where do I find them is two words, and it is Google Alerts. So there might be some listeners who do not know this, but if you just Google Alerts, then you will find a page where you can set up certain search terms, and rather than searching for it there and then, you can tell Google to email you whenever there's a new article being posted, including that search term, which means that in your email box, you will then get pling, pling, pling. You will hear about it immediately when a new article pops up. I actually, before this interview, I had a look, and I have 121 Google Alerts set up.
Right.
And I have them all set up to email me once a week instead of once a day, or even worse, you can also set it to email you immediately when something gets posted online.
And the dopamine hit there would just be too much, wouldn't it?
Oh, I would advise everybody strongly to not do that. Yeah. But if you set it up for once a week, then it gathers all the relevant articles for you. And I have searches for the names of linguists that often post something. I have searches for all the world Englishes that there are. So, for example, Nigerian English, whenever something comes up about that, I'll see it. And then some obvious search terms like neologism.
Right, okay.
Slang. And then what it's done for me is that I read all these emails in the morning because they all arrive at 8 o'clock in the morning. And it's taken over my social media use. So I, instead of scrolling social media and doom scrolling or things like that, I actually scroll through all the articles, and lots of them are gunk. But every now and then, let's say one in five, one in six is actually really interesting. And then I read it, and then I decide if it's interesting enough for my newsletter. And that's what I do.
Yeah. Have you found any particular sources that have been really useful? Any particular websites or outlets that you'd recommend?
Yeah, great question. And I actually have a good answer to that, because when I started my newsletter, which was now about 3/4 of a year ago, I was actually surprised by the fact that there wasn't a very good outlet, and it was kind of a gap in the market. And I feel like that gap in the market has now been filled by something called The Conversation, which is where academics write accessible articles about their research. And I've really, while publishing my newsletter, I've kind of seen it grow and seen more academics post on there.
Yeah, it's a great resource. I mean, I think we've definitely seen more linguists writing for it. So I know Amanda Cole at University of Essex has written quite a lot. Rob Drummond, Manchester Met. Various other people who we've interviewed on the podcast in the past have written for it, and you kind of get the sense that they're on top of research, aren't they? And they're genuinely kind of making that accessible. It's less sort of opinion writing about language and reacting to language, is it? It's more, here's some really interesting stuff that we've been doing, and here's why it's interesting.
And that's exactly what I was looking for, because when you start sort of just Googling around, then yes, you get angry people.
Yes. Yeah.
With prescriptivist views, which firstly, to start with, I actually sometimes included these in my newsletter because I thought it was interesting to see what the other side thought. But then after I'd been doing my newsletter for a few months, I noticed that they just repeat.
Yeah.
It's just always the same. It's the same griping and the same complaints. So sometimes I still will, because I had a Canadian father whose child was speaking with an English accent because of Peppa Pig.
Oh, right. I remember this.
Which I think is hilarious, you know, and he was angry about it.
But it's interesting you say that about the kind of repeated gripes, because I think that's something we definitely do on the A-level, you know, with our students here for English language, is we look at the discourses around language, around change and diversity, and they generally fall into very, very identifiable patterns where, you know, you get people complaining about decline or collapse or pollution or disease, that, you know, that there's often these kind of big metaphors used. And, you know, whatever it is that they're talking about in terms of the particular language issue that's really annoyed them that day, whether it's, you know, young people slang or while talking with an English Peppa Pig accent, they generally will kind of go into those main areas. So it's quite a useful experience, I think, for students to see whatever the complaints are, they tend to, you know, fall into those patterns. And I guess kind of historically that's been the case as well, hasn't it? When you look at, you know, complaints that date back centuries about young people's language.
It's always, yeah. Young people are ruining our language.
Well, exactly. Yes. Yeah. Whenever that was, you know, and about technology. So that whole kind of thing as well, where people complain now about, you know, TikTok language or YouTube voice, or, you know, young people using abbreviations and emojis in certain ways. But when you go back to, you know, the mobile phone and texting 20, 30 years ago,
I remember that.
The landline, people used to complain about that and the way that would change the way we spoke. And then the printing press has been like the tool of the devil and all of that. It's they're always there, aren't they?
Exactly. Yeah.
So prescriptivists can be useful, can't they? So what have been some of your favourite recent stories about language in the news? What do you like about them? What interested you most about these? You mentioned the one about Dutch language teaching. Any others that you...
Yeah, so I have three set up, and one is that a lady called Valerie Friedland, who is a professor in America, has written a book that is basically meant for my newsletter. And her book is called Like Literally Dude, Arguing for the Good in Bad English.
Yes, I saw this. I saw a review of this. It looks brilliant.
Yeah. And this is also a funny thing from if you compile a newsletter like I do, is that you see it when academics start doing the media rounds, because they'll have a new book out and then suddenly all these articles will pop up from various publications, which are all interviews or whatever. And Valerie Friedland has been doing podcasts and writing articles, and they're just brilliant. So the one that is going to be in my next newsletter is where she discusses the word like,
right,
and she discusses the way people complain about it. But then she also, and she does this very well, I find, she really takes the time to explain and give examples as to why this part of language is actually functional. Like when people complain about it, they don't see that it's actually doing something communicative. And two examples that she gives are when you say, then he was like, I have to go. Well, then he was like, I have to go. And a prescriptivist would say, well, you can just say, then he said,
yeah,
I have to go. And she makes the point, no, those are actually two different sentences. Because when you say, and then he was like, I have to go, you're saying that that was probably not literally what he said.
Right, yeah.
That was the feeling that I got from him before he left, you know?
Like,
and then he was like, I'm out of here.
Yes.
Yeah.
No, that's an interesting one, isn't it? Yeah.
And the other example was, I worked for like 80 hours.
Yeah.
Where the like is telling you very clearly that it's not literally 80 hours. Mm. You know, you just worked for a very long time and it felt like 80 hours. So yeah, I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? I mean, it's you mentioned about sort of prescriptivist gripes a few minutes ago. And I think that's one of those that we see again and again, isn't it? About, you know, young people always saying like, and actually maybe they are using it more because you've got more of these functions for it than there were before. It's actually more multi-use, isn't it?
Yeah.
Now that sounds interesting. I mean, I think that sounds like a great book as well for the course.
Yeah. I heard she was speaking in a podcast interview and she said that the way she structured the book was that she made one chapter for every complaint that she got after she would give talks. So,
right,
you know, as an English professor, she would give talks, and then there would always be people who came up to her and said, oh, don't you hate it when people say this and this and this? And again, it's what we just said. They keep repeating all these complaints.
Yes.
So yeah, she made every sort of complaint category into one chapter.
Right.
And I thought that was such a great way.
Yeah, very much. Yes.
Writing a book.
Yeah. I mean, I think whenever you sort of start to ask people or, you know, canvas opinions about things they don't like about language, you open the floodgates, don't you? And I think there was a recent example of that here with Susie Dent, who's normally I think she's normally quite good on language issues,
yeah,
and quite kind of informed and, you know, has a language background, doesn't she? She posed a question on Twitter saying, which words would you like banished from the English,
yeah,
language? And it was like, oh, it was an absolute overwhelming pee fest with people saying, well, I hate the way these people use, yeah, language. It's like, well, dear. I think she managed to turn it into something interesting looking at the histories of some of those.
She did quite well in the end because she wrote a few pieces about this. Mm. Again, Susie Dent is one of my Google alerts. So
right,
I read everything she writes.
Yeah.
So she did mention somewhere that it was a tongue-in-cheek question. And then she went on to explain that, you know, this is not how dictionaries work. So, I mean, this is Susie Dent is extremely good at media, isn't she? She,
yeah,
is very good at promoting herself. You have to respect this. So she knew exactly what she was doing. She knew exactly how much interest this was going to get, because there have been, I mean, as I say, my Google alerts, I think there's been about 10 different articles about this,
right,
one tweet,
yeah,
in various different online publications and newspapers.
Mm.
So, you know, she definitely did it on purpose, and kudos to her.
Yeah, good way of crowdsourcing material as well.
Exactly. And then she said, oh, yes, now I've made this top 10 of the gripes, and here is why you actually should not really complain, yeah, well, about it. So she did, yeah, a good job at turning it around, I think. It got everybody talking, that one.
Any other stories that you think would be of interest to students?
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's of interest to students, but something to talk about when we talk about my subject, which is the future of English, is, I think, ChatGPT and AI.
Yeah.
And the most interesting thing from the past week or two is that Yuval Harari, don't know if you've heard of this, who is, of course, a very famous writer. He writes about the history of mankind, or he has written about the history of mankind. And he likes to, as a historian, he also likes to ponder the future of mankind. And he has written a lot of articles. This is another thing where he has found something that's really grabbed the media's attention, where he is basically saying that he thinks that AI is spelling the end of civilization as we know it. He's extremely pessimistic about it. And his point, if I understand correctly, or one of his points anyway, the most language-based of his points, is that he thinks AI will take to social media, possibly being used by bad actors, say Russia, say China, say people who just want to make money anywhere in the world, because they can be anywhere in the world, people who just want to make money, who will get AI to talk to regular people, and those regular people will think that they are speaking to human beings.
Yeah.
And then what this AI will do is that it will change their opinion in the direction of something that, for example, Russia wants, or spread misinformation and things like that, whilst pretending to be just another human being.
Just another patriot from Idaho.
Yes, exactly. Something like that. And he is very worried about this. And funnily enough, it kind of made me optimistic. And I'd be very interested to hear what you think of this, because I think that if that were... It's not if, when that is to happen, I think people will be cleverer than that. And I think people will say, I don't want to spend my time chatting to somebody whose face I have not seen, who I have not met in real life, because you might be a robot and I don't want to chat to robots. And I think it might lead them to turn away from social media.
Yeah, maybe.
I mean, my hope.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because I think I've seen quite a lot of stories about AI and language, you know, covered in the last year or so. Some of them very, very apocalyptic. And other ones that kind of suggest, well, we can tell. I'm not so sure. I'm kind of a bit on the fence with it. I mean, I do think there's certainly, I think some of that stuff about misinformation, it's already happened.
Yeah.
You know, we can see that there are, you know, there are bot accounts that sometimes do a very good imitation of being a person, where, you know, suddenly a whole group of people jump onto some sort of cause, don't they, and start to say exactly the same thing with some sort of boilerplate message.
Yep.
But I do wonder if we are astute enough to spot that kind of stuff. And I also wonder if maybe as a sort of generational thing as well, that we may feel of a certain generation that we can see those things because we're used to that, but maybe younger people can't. And then I kind of think, well, actually, maybe it's the older people who are more at risk.
Yes, I was about to say that, because it's certainly the older gentleman who gets taken in by bots asking them for money.
Well, yeah.
And send me this much money, I will come over and marry you.
In fact, I've got to go and answer the door in a minute, because I've got a, you know, it's a Russian woman coming over.
That's a Russian bot coming.
Yeah, I do think it's an interesting one with the linguistic dimension to it, isn't it? I'd like to see a few more of those stories and see what linguists are saying about some of the sort of traits of AI. So you've talked about some of the stories that interested you there, and I think there'd be loads of those that would interest A-level students too. What sort of advice would you give to students of English, whether they're A-level students, undergrads, you know, grammar school students in the Netherlands, to keep an eye out for in language stories? What would your top tips for staying on top of them be?
Right, well, top tip number one is subscribe to my newsletter. It's called English in Progress, and it's on Substack. And I'm sure it's going to be in the show notes.
Yes, we'll put a link to that in the show notes, yeah.
Thank you. And I mean, I said subscribe to my newsletter kind of tongue-in-cheek, of course. I mean, people don't have to do that, but it is true that my Google Alerts system it does take up quite a lot of time. So I think if you set up a few Google alerts for the terms that you are really super interested in, I think that's a great idea. But you won't be covering everything that way. But my tip too, of course, would be to follow Inlang blog on Twitter.
What an amazing bit of advice.
And again, I don't say it jokingly because I mean it seriously, but there are fewer and fewer Twitter accounts that are bringing this kind of news or that are passing interesting articles on. And I do think that this kind of division of social medias is to blame for that. You know, it used to be everybody was either on Twitter or on Facebook or on maybe Instagram, and that was it. And now everybody's on one of a gazillion platforms. Yeah. And there is just, you can no longer keep an eye on language news on Twitter, for example, because it's just not all there anymore.
Yeah, it's an interesting one because, I mean, I sort of moved a lot of the stuff that I was doing on the Inlang blog, the original sort of blog was doing about, that's probably about 15 years ago now, set that up. Moved a lot of that onto Twitter when I kind of realized Twitter was an interesting place to be, and I was getting loads of, picking up loads of stories from linguists on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
All teachers were there, students were following it as well. But as you say, it's very fragmented, and I don't like Twitter as a place very much in many respects now. I think it's gone right down the dumper.
Yeah.
It's still quite a useful place to connect. But as you say, it's kind of fragmented. So, I mean, I've got a Blue Sky account and Mastodon, things like that. But it's about sort of finding those, isn't it? And I think your newsletter is a really great place where you've actually kind of gathered that. So, students don't have to do all those searches. Yeah. They can use the work you've done, which is great.
I'm so glad to hear that, because that was exactly the reasoning that I chose to have a newsletter and to not have. I have some social media accounts, but I don't do very much with them, because you just don't reach very many people anymore.
Mm.
Everybody's all over the place.
Yeah.
Although I might say that I think that for linguistics, Mastodon is probably, it's still not a great place to be.
It's a bit slow.
But it's probably the best place to be if you're interested in linguistics and you want to have some social media account somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. Great. Thanks very much, Hedwyn. That's really interesting. And there's loads of good things in there for students to think about in terms of keeping up with language stories. So thanks very much for coming on and talking to us.
Thank you.